We're going to start a new series today in Sunday school. I want to look at the Christian life as it's illustrated in the book of 1 John. However, today we're not going to turn to 1 John. I'm just going to give an introduction to the subject. The Bible teaches very clearly that salvation of a soul is a miracle. It is a miracle of God. Miracles are monuments of God's power. Certainly the salvation of a soul is a monument of God's power. Miracles are a monument of God's sufficiency. And again, salvation is a miracle. Salvation is not only a miracle, salvation is the greatest miracle of all. It is a miracle that surpasses the miracle of creation. When you think about creation, it's truly amazing. But I believe salvation is the greatest miracle of all. All through the Scriptures, we have miracles that are recorded for our benefit. All through the Old Testament, all through the New Testament. The New Testament begins with the incarnation of Jesus Christ, which is a miracle. That God would become flesh is a miracle. The turning of water into wine is a miracle. One that cannot explain, that is by laws of nature. The miraculous feeding of over 5,000 is a miracle. The healing of individuals all through the Scriptures. We have many, many, many healing miracles recorded. I believe every healing miracle is a type of salvation. Every healing miracle was truly a miracle. But again, none of them surpass or even come close to the miracle of salvation. When God liberated the demon-possessed, those were all miracles. Those were not things that man could do in and of himself. When God raised the dead, miracles. And people looking at the miracles of the Bible, they would say, well, that's the greatest of the miracles recorded. But again, I believe the greatest of all miracles is the salvation of a soul. I don't believe any miracle is of the magnitude of the miracle of salvation. And none of the miracles recorded in the Bible are of the significance as the miracle of salvation. So has astounding, has awesome, has impressive, as all the miracles of the Bible are. None of them are more impressive. None of them are more astounding. None of them are more amazing than when God reaches down and saves a soul. Now, as you look at the miracles in the Bible, you see that miracles had a tendency to mystify the minds of man. And when God saves a soul, the greatest miracle of all, there isn't anything that mystifies man more than when God saves a soul. The world doesn't know what to do with it. The world doesn't know what to think when God saves a soul. It mystifies them. All the miracles of the Bible, they were those that amazed men. They were those that thrilled men and excited men, filled them with enthusiasm and overwhelmed them. But none like the miracle of salvation. So, you and I that are saved, we are the recipients of a miracle. When God created us, that's a miracle. Everybody, every human being, lost or saved, is a creation miracle of God. It's a miracle. I mean, if you're in the room when a baby is born, even a lost sinner realizes that a miracle has taken place. It's a miracle, the miracle of birth. But we're not only creation miracles of God. We're miracles of God's amazing grace, which goes beyond a creation miracle. Now, if we turn to Ephesians chapter 2, these are very familiar verses. Again, we're going to look at the Christian life as it's illustrated in 1 John, or the privileges or the life that we are called upon to live, because most of God's people, and all of us to one degree or another, do not live life to the fullest. We do not enjoy all the things that we could enjoy. We do not get out of life everything that God has for us. And that's because we don't live right. The Christian life ought to be a life of joy, happiness, and peace. And I'll say it right now, there may be some that don't like it. If you don't have joy, happiness, and peace, it's because you're not living right. Because if you live like God tells you to live, you're going to have it. And we'll see that very, very clearly as we look at this series. But in Ephesians 2, we see Paul spoke of the miracle of salvation. And in order to understand the miracle of salvation, we have to understand man's condition as a lost sinner. You see, the Arminian today has reduced salvation to a repeated prayer. There's no miracle in that. Any fool can say a prayer. So it's taken the greatest miracle of all and reduced it down to repeat a few words. What a tragedy. And many have bought into that, and they have lost sight of the miracle that took place when God saved their soul. He tells us in verse 1 that the unsaved sinner is dead. So if anything's going to be done for the unsaved sinner, he can't do it himself. He's dead. He can't do it himself. So if anything is going to be done, it's going to require a miracle. So he's dead. Now, he's dead spiritually. He's alive physically, as you read the first three verses. That's very plain. We're dead spiritually, we're alive physically. To be dead spiritually is to be in a state of unconsciousness toward God. The lost sinner is unconscious of God. Not saying that they don't say they believe in God, but they are unconscious of the God of the Bible. They are unconscious of the sovereign God, and they are unconscious of spiritual things. They live as if there were no God. That's how the lost world lives. Sad to say, that's how many who profess to be saved live as well. They live without any real concern for the will of God, without any real concern for the plan of God. They are unconscious toward God. Death also, of course, speaks of separation. That's what death is. Physical death is a separation of body and soul. Spiritual death is the separation of the soul from God. It is the soul being alienated from God. It is an estrangement from God and the blessings of God. That's what it means to be spiritually dead. He talks about this spiritual estrangement or spiritual separation or alienation throughout the chapter. In verse 12, he says that we are without Christ. In verse 12, he says we are without God. In verse 13, he says we're far off. In verse 17, he says we're far off. All those words speak of the same thing. That is, they all speak, looking at it from a different angle, they all speak of a separation from God, an alienation from God, an estrangement from God. So you have a dead sinner, dead in the spiritual realm, and this dead sinner is separated, alienated, estranged from God. So if anything is going to happen, God's got to do it. The sinner can't. This death speaks of hopelessness. Again, that's described in verse 12. He says, having no hope. Having no hope. You have this dead sinner estranged from God. And this dead sinner in and of themselves have no hope. None whatsoever. Again, all of this is building a case for the fact that a miracle has to take place. Not only that, but the idea of spiritual death speaks of enslavement. It speaks of being under the power, being under the dominion of Satan, being under the power and the dominion of sin, being under the power and dominion of death. Spiritually dead, and he cannot do anything about it. Cannot bring himself to life. If he could do that, then he wouldn't be dead. So he's enslaved. And he describes this in the first three verses. In verse 1, he says, who were dead in. In. That's a very important word. We were not only guilty of trespasses of sins, we were dead in. We were in it. We were in trespasses and sins. And then the very next word in verse 2, wherein. So twice, in a very few words, we are told that we were in trespasses and sins. Now, there's a big difference between committing a sin and being in sin. For all have sinned. That's true. But all also are under sin. That's even more serious. That speaks of enslavement. So we see there's this enslavement. This enslavement is described there by the word in. We see as you read on here in Ephesians 2, this enslavement is described in verse 2, where that ye walked according to the course of this world. So we were enslaved to the course of the world. You go on in verse 2 and you see that we were also in that in time past you walked according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. So we were enslaved. So you have this dead sinner, they are enslaved. We see also they're enslaved with the company of the wicked, among whom, that is the children of disobedience, we all had our conversation. Among whom, that is, we were with the children of disobedience and we lived with them, we acted like them, we were in agreement with them, we are estranged from God. A miracle is going to have to take place. But not only that, we were enslaved to the desires of the flesh. We see in verse 3, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and mind. So you see, the sinner is in very, very serious condition. The sinner is in dire straits. It's so much more than what again, the Arminian has reduced it to. Do you realize you're a sinner? Admit you're a sinner, and everything's fine. Oh, it's much more serious than that. Anybody can admit they're a sinner. And almost anybody will admit that they're a sinner. But that's no miracle. This individual is under the dominion of sin. We see the idea of spiritual death speaks of darkness. Darkness through the Bible represents sin, represents evil, represents wickedness, represents that which is vile and abominable, and most of all represents that which is demonic or satanic. And spiritual death speaks of darkness. And we were under the realm of all of these things. We were under the dominion of all of these things. But spiritual death also speaks of condemnation. Not only were we in this condition, but we were condemned. We've already been pronounced guilty. It's just a matter of waiting sentence. We were condemned already. So, and the idea of spiritual death, of course, speaks of helplessness. We're incapacitated. As a sinner dead in sins, we were incapacitated concerning spiritual things. That is, we were unable to we were unfit to produce any spiritual affections or desires toward God that would make any difference concerning our condition. I'm not saying that the lost sinner can't say a prayer. Certainly he can. I'm not saying that the lost sinner does not ever have thoughts of God. Certainly he does. But none of those things that the lost sinner does will ever make 1 ounce of difference in eternity. Because there's nothing he can do. He's helpless. He's hopeless. So this, by looking at the sinner's condition, we see it's going to take a miracle. And the miracle is described in verse 1, and you hath he quickened. That's a miracle. When God gives life to the dead, that's a miracle. In verse 5, even when we were dead in sins, and the word even there, though most would just read over that word is put there for emphasis. Even. Even when we were dead in sins, there's an emphasis there. He hath quickened us. He hath given us life. That means he has enlivened us. He aroused us from the dead. He stimulated us. He caused us to move. When God did that in the New Testament to a dead sinner, what was it called? It was called a miracle. When God raised the daughter of Jairus, what was it? It was a miracle. When God raised Lazarus from the dead, what was that? That was a miracle. When God raised the son of the widow woman of Nain, that was a miracle. And when God quickens a dead sinner, that's a miracle. Now, did Lazarus have to believe first before he come out of the grave? No. Life was imparted to Lazarus. And that was the miracle. The Lord said, Lazarus, come forth. And the miracle was God, which people could not see at that time, God imparted life to Lazarus while he was in that tomb. And as a result of that life imparted, Lazarus responded to the voice, to the command of God to come forth. And when he came forth, everyone could see that a miracle had been performed. The miracle was performed before he came forth. The miracle was performed in giving life. And the miracle is performed before you believe. You're able to believe because God gave you life in order to believe. And all these folks today that want to argue, what comes first, faith or the new birth? That's not that difficult. I mean, if faith came first, that's works. If you had to do something before God did something, I don't care what you want to call it, that's works. And salvation by works is heresy. Doesn't matter who preaches it. Doesn't matter how learned they are. It's heresy. The new birth has to come first. Life has to come first. So we're talking more than a change of opinion. It doesn't take a miracle to change one's opinion. It's not a miracle. Anybody can change their opinion. That's not a miracle. Salvation's not just a change of opinion. Salvation's not just reformation. Anybody can reform to some degree. Fear causes some to reform. The desire to please causes some to reform. We're not talking about reformation. We're talking about a miracle. Salvation is more than religious education. You can train up a child. You can teach them everything you know about the scriptures from the time they're an infant. You can give them a religious education and they can know how to act like a Christian. They can know all the terminology. They can know how to act and live like a saved person should because they've been raised that way. But that's not what salvation's about. Salvation's a miracle. Salvation is a miracle. It's more than the passing through a series of ceremonies. Anybody can do that. There's no miracle in that. And it's more than, again, just a simple prayer. Salvation is a miracle. And you and I that are saved have experienced that miracle. And my whole point, and we're still not done with the introduction, we'll conclude with that next week, but My whole point is that since such a miracle has taken place, our lives, the very lives we live, ought to be miraculous. Our lives shouldn't be like everyone else's. And that's what we want to see in this next series through 1 John, that our lives shouldn't be like everyone else's. Our lives should be miraculous because of the miracle that has taken place. It's sad today that so many of God's people, and I realize we all have bad days. We all have times we don't feel like we should. We don't act like we should. We're quite aware of that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who live their whole life that way. Something's wrong. We ought to live miraculous lives. And I believe as we look through 1 John the next several weeks, I believe we'll see that salvation, the life of a child of God, is far, far above. The privileges that we have are far, far above anything that this world knows anything about. And I just think it's time that God's people start living like they ought to. Start enjoying the things of God like we ought to. Let's look to the Lord in a word of prayer.